Good morning, members. We'll call the Tax Committee meeting to order. This morning, members, we do have a bill on the agenda. The House File 166. Representative Abrams, you want to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that House File 166 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And, Mr. Chairman, there's a technical amendment, the A1 amendment, and I'd like to move adoption of the amendment.
Representative Abrams moves the A1 amendment. All members have that in front of them. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, the amendment is adopted. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File 166 conforms Minnesota law to the first act of Congress, which passed last week, which provides that cash contributions made to charities for tsunami relief during January 2005 be available at the taxpayer's election to be deducted for purposes of the 2004 tax year. As we know, members, on December 26th, there was an earthquake that registered over 9 on the Richter scale, slightly off of an island in Indonesia, which created a tsunami that literally went from Indonesia to every other country that abuts the Indian Ocean. And not only was there devastation in places like Thailand and Sri Lanka and India and the Maldives, but it went clear to the Horn of Africa, in which there was a significant damage. The death toll currently from the tsunami, to give you an idea of scale, is greater than the death toll from the nuclear weapon that was detonated over Hiroshima. There are literally millions of people who are without homes. They have been washed away. The death toll continues to climb, and what everybody says is needed is not more goods and supplies donated, but rather money to organizations. President Bush has enlisted former President Bush and President Clinton to engage in private fundraising among American people, and the American response has been overwhelming. Rather than dwell on the tragedy itself, let me tell you what this bill does and why it's important. What this bill does is it conforms to the federal tax treatment for these charitable contributions. And decisions are being made by Minnesotans, and I would suspect that they're being made irrespective of tax treatment. I would like to think that Minnesotans and others in America are big-hearted and would make it even without Minnesota conforming. That if Minnesota does not conform to the federal provision, a couple of things happen. First, all of the income tax forms have been printed and sent out. And you would technically, if you are going to conform to Minnesota law, have to, if you have made an election to deduct this charitable contribution for your federal return in 2004, have to add it back to your Minnesota taxes on a line on the Minnesota return that says other. And I doubt seriously that very many Minnesotans are going to have that degree of sophistication. They will just pick up the deduction that they make for federal purposes and move on and pick it up. So the other thing that it triggers is if there's something in the other line, the Department of Revenue normally picks up the telephone and calls the taxpayer and says, what is in the other line here? So there are some administrative savings that go along with this. Now, this provision does benefit primarily itemizers and AMT payers and corporations. There is some argument if it also picks up the deduction that people who do not itemize are able to take in Minnesota for charitable contributions of greater than $500. Minnesota is unique. I believe it was Governor Pawlenty who had the provision, which says that if you are a non-itemizer and make a charitable contribution of greater than $500, you're able to deduct contributions, I believe, at a 50% rate above the $500 minimum threshold. So, again, there's an argument about that, and I'm sure that I'll be talking to Senator Rust to make sure that the bill is cleaned up in order to be able to take care of it. But members, not only for the tax fairness and simplicity argument is this the right thing to do, it's just the right thing to do, period. When you take a look at the tapes as to what occurred, you know, our hearts just have to go out to these people when you see walls of water literally 30 or 40 feet high taking out entire cities that are inland by over a mile. And think about the devastation. I think that our response has to be to try to do what we can for those folks under these rather extraordinary circumstances. So that's the presentation on House File 166 as amended, and be very happy to answer members' questions.
Members, are there any questions of the author? Representative Rukavina.
Representative Abrams, how many, do you know how many, what percentage of the income tax filers are able to itemize, or what percentage of the population are we talking about? I mean, my daughter immediately got on her computer and looked for a charitable organization that spent the least amount administratively, of course, my daughter, she looked at that, Representative Abrams, and then she went and paid gave a contribution, and I'm sure, I know she doesn't itemize and deduct, and I would suspect that most people that gave to the tsunami or to charities in general probably don't, but do you know the number?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, according to the November 2004 forecast, 658,000 Minnesotans will have a state benefit from the itemized deduction for charitable contributions for the year 2004. I would suspect that everybody who itemizes does make charitable contributions, at least I hope so, Representative Rukavina. So that would be roughly 35% of Minnesota income tax filers file an itemized return. And again, you know, right before the meeting, Ms. Manzi told me that there's an argument regarding the non-itemizer deduction that we have if this bill would affect them. Certainly my intent that it does, Representative Rukavina, and I'll be talking to the department and also Senator Rest to make sure that if your daughter's not an itemizer, Representative Rukavina, and has more than $500 annually of $500 in contributions during calendar year 2004, that should be able to get the benefit of that that provision as law, in law as well, Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Maybe that question, like radical labor organizations, are they nonprofits? I'm sure she gives to that. You know?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, the federal government determines what is a charitable organization for purposes of Section 170 of the Internal Revenue Code, and I will personally express no opinion if a radical labor organization can or cannot qualify for charitable treatment under Section 170.
Members, in your packet you have the Department of Revenue analysis of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I do want to tell you what
Representative Abrams.
You know, to show you how circular this can be. If you do not know yourself that you're supposed to add this back, or you don't have a very, very, very good accountant that tells you that you must add this back, here's how it's found out. If the Department of Revenue does a field audit, which they do very, very few of, and decides to take a look at the charitable contributions made. And they provide the documentation to the Department of Revenue. And they find a check dated between January 1st and January 31st, 2005. And they say, aha, you shouldn't have taken this deduction for purposes of your 2004 income tax. That's how they discover it. But the remedy is that you have to file an amended return for 2004. And then you're going to have to file an amended return for 2005 because the deduction is available in 2005. So the ability to actually find this is really, members, quite small. And the amount of work that would go in order to find these people who have made this unwitting mistake, you know, it almost boggles the mind that anybody would care about it. But I just wanted to point that out for members to understand what nonconformity means. You're basically saying we're going to conform to something that 99.9% are going to do this way anyway.
Representative Abrams, you're not planning on using this as a vehicle for federal conformity on the last 3 years of federal tax code, are you?
Well, Representative Franke, to show you that former tax chairs, of which you will join that fraternity or sorority someday, think alike, I had put in my list of things to do on Sunday to call up the staff to get a bill like this drafted, and Senator Rest gave me a call and said that she was having this bill drafted. And she said, you're not going to be using this for any vehicle, you know, or to or to embarrass the DFL caucus in any manner, way, shape, or form. And I told them, Representative Franke, that I just couldn't imagine that anybody but perhaps you.
there's a new sheriff in town, Senator Abrams, so anyway. We could ask anyone on the committee if they were intending to do that. So, so members, just a clarification.
The DFL caucus or
no? members, we believe that in the new era of bipartisanship and cooperation with the Senate, that this bill is going to hopefully move through both bodies without amendment and can be forwarded to the governor in short order. So are there again to the let's go back to the revenue analysis. Are there any questions regarding the revenue analysis? Mr. Michael, you want to give us 60 seconds on what we're doing in terms of actual dollars?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the way the department has analyzed this, essentially it will shift the $35,000 in cost from 2005, or it actually from fiscal 2005 to 2006, and there's a net cost of $5,000 in that they're assuming that this will slightly increase the amount of charitable contributions, but the overwhelming effect is just the change in when these costs are recognized, so that if they're recognized in 05 rather than in 06. On the other point, if the committee wishes to make it absolutely clear that this does apply to non-itemizers, I have drafted language that would do that. It could slightly, if I believe that these estimates were prepared on the assumption that they only applied to itemizers, so that might affect the cost slightly. But I do have language if the committee wishes to do that.
Representative Abrams, do you want to move that amendment?
I do want to move that amendment, and Mr. Chairman, it's only right and proper that anybody who gets a charitable deduction, be it an itemizer or non-itemizer, get the same treatment for being generous and making a cash contribution for tsunami relief in January. It's only the right thing to do.
Mr. Michael, you want to read the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the amendment would read on page 5, line 7, after purposes, insert and apply to the subtraction under subdivision 19B, comma, clause 7.
Just for the record, you want to repeat the amendment, please, Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, the amendment is page 5, line 7, after purposes, insert and apply to the subtraction under subdivision 19B, clause 7.
Are there any questions or any comments to the amendment? Seeing none, we'll vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion? Any further comments? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on behalf or in opposition to the legislation? Sir, come on before the down to the table and give us your comments. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chair and members of the House of Representatives. My name is Omar Jamal. I'm the Director of the Somali Justice Advocacy Center. I just would like to bring to your attention that the importance of this bill, and Somali being in Horn of Africa is one of the countries that get affected of this, and at least reported, because of the magnitude of the death and the damage is much less than compared to other countries. However, still, our office is receiving checks from the citizens of the state, and hopefully they will take advantage out of the bill that's getting passed today, and I hope this will get expedited through the process to the Senate, and eventually the sooner it ends up in front of the governor, because the crisis is really huge, and the extension and the generosity from our country or our state will be very much appreciated, and I hope that today's, I'm surprised there's so many people from the Far East Asia or from Africa not present at this bill today, because it relates to this crisis, and I want to express my appreciation and thanks to all of you who are really trying to do an extend hand to the far corner of the other side of the globe. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Appreciate your being here. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who cares to testify on behalf or in opposition to legislation?
Do my motion, Mr. Chairman.
If not, Representative Abes renews his motion that House File 166 be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those who are opposed, the motion is adopted. Members, you have the minutes from the previous meeting in front of you. Are there any additions, corrections? Representative Knobloch?
Move the minutes.
Representative Knobloch moves the minutes of the meeting of Tuesday, January 11th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. Minutes are adopted. Now, members, we'll go back to having a review or overview from the House Fiscal Analysts. A little bit on Dr. Wilson. What are we going to start with today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we finished with the overview for state taxes last time, but before beginning the overview for property taxes, I think it was on your advice to spend a little bit of time on process issues. So we'll begin by talking, fiscal staff talking about revenue estimates, fiscal notes, local fiscal impact statements, and spreadsheet issues, and then I think House Research will spend some time on some modeling issues of what House Research can do for members in terms of modeling the impact of proposals. After that, then continue with property tax presentation.
Terrific. Proceed.
Okay, members, there should be in your packet a handout with the fiscal analysis department heading on it. The title of it at the top is Revenue Estimates. And Ray Zimmerman and I will go through this handout fairly quickly, but there is some important information, particularly for people who are new to the committee, about how to request information and what the information means to you. So I'll just proceed through that document. I want to begin by talking about revenue estimates. You've seen a revenue estimate this morning for the tsunami bill. Revenue estimates simply show how a bill, the bill language, will change state tax collections or state expenditures for property tax relief programs. Keep in mind that a revenue estimate does not estimate how the bill language will affect the administrative costs of either state agencies or local government. So administrative costs are ignored on a revenue estimate. But if you look at the tsunami revenue estimate, you'll see in the upper right-hand corner of that revenue estimate, you'll see some boxes. If the Department of Revenue thinks that there are significant administrative costs or savings from a bill, they will make a note by checking. Now, I notice they did not check either box, yes or no, on the tsunami bill. We will check for them and see which box is appropriate, but I assume they were implying that it was no. The revenue estimate also includes a fairly detailed explanation of how the Department of Revenue comes up with its estimate. So the revenue analysis detail is important for you if you present a bill. It gives you enough detail. They're very open in how they come up with their estimate so that it can be clear and you can raise questions about the assumptions that they are using. Every revenue estimate is based on the latest forecast. So if you have a revenue estimate for, say, an income tax cut now, when the new forecast comes out, that revenue estimate will change. So you should be prepared for any kind of change in the forecast, it may change the revenue estimate for your bill. The revenue estimates are prepared by the Department of Revenue, and in Minnesota, at least in recent years, we have not had dueling estimates. In other words, the estimates made by the Department of Revenue are the estimates used in fiscal tracking. The Department uses several assumptions that you may want to be aware of because, as we've seen even this morning, they raise some questions in members' minds about how the revenue estimates are made. And I list a number of assumptions here. First of all, the estimates use static analysis as opposed to what is sometimes referred to as dynamic scoring or dynamic analysis. Revenue estimates will not give your bill credit for stimulating the economy and making the economy grow faster. If you have a bill for single factor apportionment that you think will create jobs and the testimony will create jobs and expand the economy, revenue estimates will not take that into account. We'll basically assume that the forecast growth in the economy in the latest forecast is what will occur. So be aware you don't get that in revenue estimates, or at least have not in the past. Secondly, there's no credit for causing a new facility to be built. If you have a bill to provide a sales tax exemption for a particular project, and you believe that without that sales tax exemption, that project will not be built, the Department of Revenue will assume that the project will be built without the sales tax exemption, and you will see a revenue loss from the sales tax exemption or a cost to the state. So just be aware that the Department of Revenue does not make assumptions about what is the make or break tax break for a particular project. And so there's often questions about how this could be a cost if the belief is that the project would not go forward otherwise. There are some behavioral responses that are taken into account in revenue estimates. For example, if you propose a cigarette tax increase, there is a lot of empirical evidence, a lot of studies on how cigarette consumption responds to changes in taxes and prices. And so the department does, in its modeling, take into account the reduction in smoking, the reduction in purchase of packs and cigarettes in Minnesota in response to a higher tax and a higher price of cigarettes. So behavioral responses are taken into account sometimes, but not in all cases. Generally, estimates assume 100% compliance, and you've seen an example of that this morning. They are assuming that people will, in fact, correctly add back the tsunami relief to their tax return, and therefore they're estimating what the cost is compared to 100% compliance with the law. That raises questions, as Representative Abrams raised this morning, about the estimates, but that is the standard practice in revenue estimates by the department. And finally, it's based on the Department of Revenue interpretation of law. A couple of years ago, there was a proposal, or last proposal, to give an exemption for certain telecommunications equipment. The exemption, there was an argument about whether the telecommunications equipment was actually taxable for sales tax purposes under current law. The department said it was and gave a revenue estimate showing a significant cost for that exemption. The Supreme Court then ruled that the exemption was, in fact, that these expenditures were not actually taxable under law. So basically, there was no, it basically was already in effect. So the Department of Revenue's interpretation of law is what is used as the basis for revenue estimates, and that can sometimes be, we'll see examples this session where that becomes a controversial assumption, but you'd expect that assumption in revenue estimates. How do you request them? You can request them by contacting either me or contacting Marie Zimmerman. But basically, if a bill is scheduled for a hearing, the revenue estimate will automatically be requested. As soon as the bill is scheduled, there is an automatic request to the department for a revenue estimate for that bill, so you don't need to request one in that case. The timing of completion depends upon the DOR staff workload. These are often available only, as we saw this morning, right before the session, the day before, or even the day of the legislative hearing. So getting these in advance, sometimes we'll get them in advance, but you should not count on it. You will get, as a chief author of the bill, you will get an emailed copy of the revenue estimate as soon as it is completed to you. And you'll get that as fast as I will get it. So if you are having a bill that has a hearing, you want to check that. We can also get estimates at times for bills that are not scheduled for a hearing, but they are given much lower priority. We can sometimes get estimates, official estimates even, for ideas or things you're developing as a bill. You're considering doing something and you want a confidential estimate of what it would cost. We can sometimes get those, but again, they tend to be lower priority than the bills for being heard in committee.
Doc, was just do you have a question, Representative Mallory?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Wilson, on the issue of interpretation of the law by the department, at what point do they, let's say, give in to the courts? In other words, district court, appellate court, state Supreme Court, federal district court, or do they not give in until the U.S. Supreme Court, if that's a possibility here?
I think I would defer that question to Joel Michael, actually, who may have a better answer to it than I do.
If it can be answered quick, not like go unanswered.
I think basically, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, that they wait until the decision is final. So, for example, if there's a tax court case that the department is appealing to the Supreme Court, I think they still would score it based on their interpretation. So it's, I believe it's the finality of the decision.
A couple other comments on revenue estimates. If you have questions, obviously, on what they say, feel free to contact us. We can be in contact then with the department analysts and get additional information for you if you need be. If you think when you get the revenue estimate that it does not reflect the intent of your bill, you did not intend to do what the bill said, what the revenue estimate said it's doing, then you can work with us or with House research staff to amend your bill so it matches the intent, and the revenue will then be scored based upon what you intended it to do rather than how they interpret the language. Again, an example of that this morning was on the non-itemizer deduction. If you rescore it, you can get an additional estimate. And finally, if you plan on making an amendment to your bill at the time of the hearing, if you're the author and you want to make an amendment to the bill, an author's amendment, we'd appreciate knowing about that amendment ahead of time if it will affect the revenue estimate, because we can send that revenue estimate to revenue and they will make the estimate based upon the amended bill, so you'll get an estimate based upon what you really are intending to do. The revenue estimates are available online. The revenue estimate is given at the top of the second, the website address, which is fairly complicated, is given at the top of the second page as a handout. Every revenue estimate completed since 1999 is on there. They're indexed only by bill number, so it's not a searchable database, so you have to know the bill number. Since 2004, they're listed under both the House bill number and the Senate bill number for the companion bill. prior to that, you may have to know the companion bill's number in order to find the revenue estimate for an older bill. And again, there may be multiple estimates. If they do and update the estimate for an amended version, they'll leave the old estimate on there, so make sure you're looking at the right estimate if you book them up in that way. Fiscal notes are a completely different animal from revenue estimates. Fiscal notes, the importance for tax committee members is a fiscal note provides estimates of the administrative costs to state agencies of a bill. In practice, a fiscal note for a tax bill needs to be requested only if the tax bill is going to have an impact, or you think it's going to have an impact on state costs. An example would be if you have a new tax that you're proposing, if you are changing administration of tax in a major way, or if you propose a tax credit that adds a line to the tax return, which will raise printing costs or mailing costs. In those cases, you should have a fiscal note requested. But in other cases, for most tax bills, revenue estimate is all that's needed, and there's no need to request a fiscal note. Fiscal notes are prepared by the Department of Finance. They basically have a 5-day turnaround time, less time than that if needed. Unlike revenue estimates, in other words, they're done in the order they are submitted in a fairly quick timeline. You do not have to have a hearing scheduled, in other words, to get the priority for a fiscal note. If you want to request a fiscal note, we would appreciate it if you contact Marie or myself, just because we can sometimes determine whether it's in fact needed. So if you want to request a fiscal note, feel free to contact us. They, again, since 1999, all fiscal notes are found on the website of the Finance Department, and that is a searchable website, so it's much easier to find fiscal notes in some ways than the revenue estimates.
Mr. Chairman, the third item on the handout is local impact notes, and local impact notes are similar to fiscal notes, except they estimate the fiscal impact of proposed legislation on local governments and school districts. Some examples of completed local impact notes from 2003 and 2004 include 0.08 child support procedures and the 2 a.m. bar close. So most of the completed notes are not necessarily bills that would be in the jurisdiction of the tax committee. However, only the ranking minority member or the chair of the House or Senate Tax Committee can request a local impact note from the Commissioner of Finance. The process usually involves the chair or ranking minority member requesting a local impact note for a specific bill. The Department of Finance determines whether the bill is exempt from the local note process, and some of those exceptions are included in the handout. Finance will typically seek input from agency staff, fiscal staff, local government associations, and local units of government to determine fiscal impact, and usually this is done in an advisory group type setting. And also, one other important thing to note is that the local impact note process can be a lengthy process that can take up to several weeks. So unlike a fiscal note or a revenue estimate where if your bill is being heard next week, we can usually get one for you. Usually it can take up to several weeks. So that's just one thing to note about that. And then we also wanted to talk about the fiscal tracking sheets that Paul and I prepared for the committee. The first comprehensive fiscal tracking sheet will be prepared for the governor's budget recommendations, and then we will update that for the 2005 February forecast. The next comprehensive spreadsheet will be prepared when the committee puts together the omnibus bill, and then when we get to conference committee, we will obviously put together a side-by-side of House, Senate, and conference, and governor. And all tracking sheets are available on our website for the current session and previous sessions back to 1995. And then the only other thing we wanted to call your attention to is on the last page is fiscal staff publications. And I just wanted to highlight three things under the Money Matters publications. First is the glossary of fiscal terms and acronyms that we just updated this month. The second thing is the summary of the fiscal actions of the legislative sessions. We have those on our website going back to 1995, and those can be a very useful reference document for what we've done. The third thing is an overview of the governor's budget recommendations, and those are also on our website going back to 1995. And those documents are for all budget areas, but typically when we do them, we will send just the taxes, aid, and credits piece via email to all the members of the committee. And that's it. And I will, Mr. Chairman, I will let House Research come up and make a presentation.
Any questions then on the process of revenue estimates, local impact notes, other? If not, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I'm next on the agenda. Steve Hines from House Research. And I just wanted to speak briefly about the handout that was passed out, I think, the last thing you see, which is a one-page sheet that says House Research Computer Simulation Policy. Just wanted to touch upon the fact that the in-house research and we do have some simulation models in the areas of school finance, aids to local governments, that's county aids and LGA, others, income tax burdens and property tax burdens. And I should say some of this capability is also overlaps with or also shared with the fiscal analysis department. A couple of things that sometimes are issues that come up that we wanted to touch on this morning are some policies that we've developed over the years in dealing with disseminating results from these kinds of simulation models. One question that comes up all the time is lead time, and all we really say here is that we can't give you a definite answer about lead time because it depends to such a great degree on the complexity of the proposal that we're being asked to look at. Is it a big change from current law versus a small change? Is there data available easily to make some guesses or not? So the more lead time you give us, the better, and we just try to let you know at the time you ask how long we think it will take. Other issues that come up have to do sometimes with confidentiality. And as with any request to House Research, any time you're working with an analyst from House Research, it's completely confidential between the member and the analyst or analysts in House Research. And I believe these policies also would carry over to the fiscal analysis department. As you're developing your proposal, you as members can, of course, feel free to include other people in the dialogue, but we would not bring anyone else into it unless you authorized us to. Now, once a proposal becomes public, then it becomes a different situation. It can become public typically through a bill being introduced, but sometimes it comes public as a press conference. Once a proposal is public, then anyone can ask us to do a simulation of it. And that's, I think, the area where some confusion has come up in the past. So once you've developed your proposal and sort of made an announcement through the newspaper or whatever, then be aware that somebody, even if you haven't distributed simulation output, somebody else might ask for it and might be at it and might be asking us to develop it. In light of that, especially with regard to the property tax model, we do have some more complex rules that say even if you ask for somebody else's proposal, we're going to give it to the author first to give them a short period of time to react. If there's time, all the timelines are kind of get accelerated or compressed when there's a hearing imminent, because we will always try to make sure the information is available for the committee or for floor session when it comes to that. So these are things to just be aware of, and this will be posted on the House Research website as to how some of these policies come into play. Page 2 of that handout, I'm not going to go into any great detail, but it just talks a little bit about the level of detail of the, particularly of the AIDS modeling and the property tax modeling. There's some confusion about when you can get individual city runs or not. This tries to lay out that scenario and why we do it the way we do it. And I don't think I want to go into that detail now, but feel free to ask questions now or later on it as they come up. And are there any questions? Otherwise, we're ready to move into then the property tax overview that we didn't get to last Tuesday. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I guess I'm going to start out the property tax presentation. My name is Karen Baker from House Research, and on the first overhead, the state and local tax pie chart that you have, the only reason we included it in this presentation is to kind of give you another flavor or kind of update of how much property tax is of the total, and it shows property tax as being that 27%, and that equals $5.4 billion, and that amount actually, and that amount does include the statewide general tax of the $621 million. Moving on to the second slide, who does what in the property tax system? The property tax is the counties are responsible for property tax administration, but the Department of Revenue provides a lot of assistance, oversight, and guidelines to the many officials that are involved in the property tax system. What this shows you is just kind of the various different people that are involved or offices. There's the assessor who is valuing and determining, valuing the property, setting the classification of the property, sending out notices. At the same time, there's also the taxing jurisdictions that are very busy establishing budgets and determining how much of that budget the property tax needs to bring in, and sending their property tax levies, both proposed and final, to the county auditor. The county auditor then is going through various steps of determining jurisdictions' tax bases and calculating tax rates, TNT, or truth in taxation, comes into play, so the county auditor is doing both the truth in taxation rates as well as final. And then the county treasurer, who obviously is preparing and mailing out property tax statements, collecting tax, and making all the distributions. In many counties, some of these offices are also combined, so you may have a county where an auditor, a treasurer, is the same or the same office. There also is, and we don't have a slide, but on page 5 in the handout, there is it just shows the 2-year calendar, and I just refresh your memory on that the property tax is a 2-year cycle, and that actually goes through that, that 2-year period. Next one is just a quick recap of a few of the property tax terms that we have, and the terms that we really have picked up here is just the real basic terms of the county assessor determining each property's taxable market value, and I'll talk in just a couple minutes about LMV and EMV, but this is the actual taxable market value that taxes are actually computed on. Then the next term is net tax capacity, and that equals that taxable market value times the class rate, and we'll talk about the classifications in a few minutes. Each local jurisdiction, when it's set its levy, which is what I mentioned, and that levy then is divided by the tax base to equal the tax rate, which is done by computed by the auditor. Moving on then to the gross property tax, that equals the net tax capacity times the tax rate, and it's done for all taxing jurisdictions. So you're doing it separately for the county and for the city and the school and each special taxing district, and then adding all of them together when they talk about a total tax rate. And then, of course, net tax equals your gross tax minus any credits. And each of these pieces will be talked about in just a few minutes. Then on the limited market value, I'd like to make a few. Limited market value is it applies to certain classes of property. It applies to agricultural. It applies to residential, seasonal rec classes, and for property taxes payable in 2005, the growth is limited to, and it's a formula that we have set in law, which is 15% of your payable 2004 value, or 25% of the difference. And again, in the actual handout that we've given you, there is an actual schedule of how that has been phasing out, and and also it shows how much of the actual tax base has been excluded over the last several years. But LMV is being phased out, and it will have no effect after taxes payable in 2007. So after this year's taxes, we have two more years of LMV. I guess the one thing that I would like to mention on LMV is, remember, limited market value is not what the assessor is determining your property to be worth. That's estimated market value. What limited market value is what the legislature has set in statute for how much it is actually going to, or how much your value is actually going to be taxable. So, and the phase out you can see on page 9 of the handout, if you want to, you know, you can kind of look at how much of that tax base has been excluded over the years, and it did reach a peak, and now it's going down. So there's less being actually excluded than there was a couple of years back. I'm going to turn it over to Steve for some class rate description.
Kind of then on to page 10 of your handout, and again, most of you have some, if not already, a great deal of familiarity with this topic, so I'll try to move through kind of quickly. But the class rate schedule is the factor that turns a property's market value or taxable value into its tax capacity. That's the basis for it. It's the amount that is going to be taxed in the property tax system. And compared to how things used to be, there's now a much narrower range of class rates, not only a narrower range, but also fewer different class rates. They're pretty much just four, I think it's just about four class rates. The 0.55 class rate for the lowest tier of ag homestead property, a 1% class rate, which is what first tier of homesteads, first tier of cabins, first tier of non-homestead property, lots of property classes are at 1%. 1.25%, which is the class rate that applies to the upper tiers of the classes I just mentioned at a 1%. Also, 1.25 would be the rate for apartments and for non-homestead residential property of two or three units, the duplexes or triplexes. And then finally, our 1.5%, which is the rate on the first 150,000 of commercial industrial property, and 2% the rest of the commercial industrial class. Again, compared to how things used to be, this range is both narrower and there are fewer different kinds of class, or different fewer numbers of classes out there. page 11 sort of takes that class rate information and looks at then what happens to just for a property worth $120,000, depending upon what type of property it is, to see how different the taxes end up being on the same value of property. And this is a factor of both the class rate system and the system that are in place that we're going to talk about later in the presentation. But you can see that for that same $120,000 market value of property, the tax can be as low as $594 in the case of ag homestead property, or all the way up to $3,200 for commercial industrial at the same $120,000 of value. And the last column in that table on page 11 is the effective tax rate. That's a term you'll hear often. A way of kind of comparing tax burdens by different kinds of property, different values of property. It's the relationship between the net tax on the property and the value after doing all the calculations in the system. And you'll see that for ag homestead, when all is said and done, and ag homestead isn't necessarily the same depending on what value you pick, because there are a few different class rates embedded in that ag homestead. But for this $120,000, the effective rate here ends up being 0.5. So half a percent of their value is the tax, versus the commercial industrial at the $150,000 or $120,000 value, the effective rate is 2.68%. The last line on that table then takes a commercial property that's actually a 10 times the amount, $1.2 million, and that's an effective tax rate of 3.4% because of the higher rate on the second tier of property. there's a slight difference between the class effective rate on the slide and on your handout because of a change in the state tax rate between the two tables were prepared. Moving on then to page 12 of the handout. This talks, again, kind of looking at the relative share of the tax burden between types of property. For statewide, for payable 2004, the relationship between a class of property share of the total market value in the state and its share of the total tax burden. And you can see homesteads constitute the largest share of the property tax base of the state, with an estimated market value that's almost 60% of the market value of all property, of all taxable property in the state, versus the share of tax that homesteads pay, which is about 45%. Contrast that then with commercial industrial property, which is about 12.5% of the tax base, the market value base of the state, and yet pays a tax burden of approximately 33%. Of the total. Ag property at 13%, almost the same amount of value as commercial industrial property, but pays only 5.7% of the tax. To show just the relative importance of the class rate system and how the class rate system has evolved along with the credits to distribute that tax burden somewhat differently from the burden you would get from just looking at market values alone. Page 13 of the handout then looks at the other side of the property tax question of where is that money going. And for 2004, again, you can see that now counties get approximately one-third of the amount of property tax revenues in the state. School districts are at about 25%, about a quarter of it. Cities are at about 20%. 25% if you include revenues from tax increment financing in the city's share. The state share is about 12%, and towns and special districts each have smaller portions. Again, this pie chart looked quite a bit different before the major restructuring of 2001. At that time, schools were nearly 50% of the total, and now their school share is down to a quarter, but the other jurisdictions have shares of that pie have come in. And of course, before 2001, there was no state share. The next, on page 14, then is the a little discussion of the state general tax, which, as we said, was new, created in 2001. Initially set at a level of $592 million, and the law provided for an inflationary increase each year based on the implicit price deflator for state local spending. As a consequence, now in 2005, that tax is up to a level of $629 million versus $592 million. Initially, that money goes to the general fund. There is no dedication of that money in the general fund. It is just general fund dollars. The tax rate initially, I should have said too that the state general tax basically falls on only two types of property, commercial industrial property and seasonal recreational property. Public utility property does also pays the tax, except that public utility property that is for generation equipment generating electrical energy is not subject to the state general tax. The rate of tax is the same on commercial industrial and on seasonal recreational, except that the first tier of seasonal recreational property, the tier under 76,000 value, pays a state tax rate that's only 40% of the full rate. So there's some modification of that rate for seasonal recreational property. The table at the bottom of page 14 shows the breakdown of the state tax revenues by type of property, 83% commercial industrial, 9% public utility, 7.2% is the non-commercial seasonal recreational share, and that share has increased a little bit over the last few years because that class of property values have been growing substantially. It's useful to maybe notice the second from the bottom bullet there, too. Initially, in 2002, the tax rate necessary to generate the $592 million was about 58%. For 2005, the rate is only about 51%, and the reason for that is that the property values in those two classes of property are growing at a faster rate than the inflation adjustment on the state general levy. Moving on then to page 15 of the handout. This is just a brief overview of the major state relief programs, property tax relief programs that we'll be covering in more detail in later pages. We just wanted to put them all on one page to sort of put them in perspective with each other as to how important or significant they are in the overall scheme of things. So you can see a local government aid is by far the largest of the state aid and property tax relief programs at about $438 million. Again, I should point out the numbers on the slides are slightly different from the number in your handout because of one table got updated for the November forecast and the other didn't, but the numbers are very close to the same. Other aid programs then in level of significance are the county program aid at $112 million for 2004, and that actually is going up substantially to over $200 million in 2005. Referendum equalization aid, again, that's not an aid that's under the jurisdiction of this committee typically, but it is an important piece of the property tax puzzle. About $107 million in referendum aid, $32 million in school debt service aid, $19 million in this relatively small amount for disparity reduction aid. Then when we get to the property tax credits, the major one there is the homestead market value credit at about $288 million. Agricultural market value credit is only $24 million. And then the final two are the property tax refund programs that go to taxpayers after the locals, after the tax statements have been mailed out and returned, kind of off the model, as we like to call it sometimes. And those programs for renters and homeowners are each at about $150 million in magnitude. Now we'll move more into a little more detail on those aid and credit programs, and new gentlemen are going to take over county programs.
Okay, in 2003, several changes were made to county aids. County program aid was created beginning in calendar year 2004. The four aids that are listed up there, then agricultural credit aid, also called HACA, attached machinery aid, county criminal justice aid, and family preservation aid, were repealed and consolidated into one general purpose aid, but the distribution of county program aid remained the same as these four aids. And then beginning in calendar year 2005, county program aid is distributed through a new funding formula, which is on the next slide. County program aid consists of three parts. $100 million is distributed under a need aid formula, and those need factors are similar to the need factors we use in county criminal justice aid and family preservation aid. $105 million is distributed under a tax-based equalization aid formula, and this portion is based on a county's revenue-raising capacity. $1.4 million is transition aid for counties that the difference between their aid under the new funding formula in 2005 and what they received after reductions in 2004 exceeds 3% of their tax base. Transition aid is paid for 3 years and then phases up to zero in 2008. And then this next slide is on page 18 of your handout. This graph shows county aid since 2003. The first bar shows what counties were certified to receive in 2003 before reductions were made. This is about $226 million. The second bar shows what counties actually received in 2003 after reductions, approximately $161 million. The third bar shows what certified county program aid was in 2004 after reductions under the old distribution, and that's about $112 million. And the fourth bar shows certified county program aid in 2005 under the new funding formula with a $95 million increase from 2004, and that's about $206 million, and that includes the transition aid.
I will take you through the next major aid program, which is the local government aid program. This program was also modified significantly during the 2003 legislative session. The main changes were the funding was greatly reduced from about 587, which was originally certified in 2003, down to a permanent appropriation level of $437.5 million annually. The other major change that occurred, one of the other major changes that occurred is prior to this change, about $360 million of this program was distributed based on grandfathered amounts, based on what cities were getting in 1994. Now $410 million out of the $437 million is distributed via the formula, and only $26 million is distributed based on, you know, some preset amount. The city LGA formula is based on paying a percentage of the difference between city need and city's ability to raise revenue locally or city's ability to pay. There are two different formulas for measuring need. There's one for small cities under 2,500, and one for large cities over 2,500. City need for small cities is based on population decline, housing built before, percentages of housing built before 1940, and the percent of property classified as commercial industrial. And these are the same factors that were used in the small city formula prior to 2003, but the coefficients attached to those have been updated using a regression analysis. For large cities, the factors used in determining city need changed significantly before 2003 and with the changes in 2003. City need for large cities is now based on population decline, percent of housing built before 1940, road accident rate, average household size, and location. The ability to raise tax revenue under the old formula was merely city tax base multiplied by an average city tax rate. That part was included, but a change that was added in the 2003 legislation is now city tax and night aid is also included in determining what a city can raise locally. In pay 2005, a city's LGA is about 84% of that difference between need minus ability to raise revenue locally. Changes in an individual city's aid on a year-to-year basis is capped, so it cannot either increase or decrease very much. It can go up or down about 10% of their current levy, of their previous year's levy. And this is kind of to reduce some of the volatility that exists in a program when everything is based only on need and you've got $400 million being redistributed every year. If you actually want a more detailed look at the formulas, you could take a look on page 20 of the handout, and it kind of talks through all the formulas. And page 21 of the handout has some graphs that show how LGA has changed over time and how much of it used to be from grandfather versus how much of it is now from this grandfathered aid. It also looks at the distribution of formula aid versus grandfathered aid, and also how much LGA is as a percentage of levy plus aid for different types of cities.
Excuse us one moment. Representative De La Forest, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Ms. Dalton. I'm just curious as to how the particular, going back to the LGA formula, how the particular need factors were selected, especially one that I'm asked and I don't know the answer to regarding the road accident rates, which is probably a question you've had before, and maybe a larger question maybe for the chairman. What sort of is the public policy underlying LGA? Why do we offer LGA?
I'm not going to touch that.
You let that hand grenade roll on by.
We have a former commissioner of the Department of Revenue in the audience. Maybe he'd like to answer that, but maybe one of the
Ms. Dalton, you want to take a swing at why we have it?
Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, one of the major rationales that has been used for justifying local government aid is that cities do not all have either equal needs or equal ability to raise revenues locally from those needs. They don't have equal tax bases. And so local government aid is to equalize cities' ability to provide basic levels of services. Why the road accident rate? The characteristics that are used in determining city need were based on a regression analysis. There were about 35 different factors that were looked at in developing this formula, and the factors that ended up being most significant were the ones that were used. These factors that were considered were based on discussions that were actually held with city representatives. And one of the things that came in is a lot of cities talked about overburden in cities, either because they had a lot of tax-exempt property, like St. Paul, where a lot of people come in to do government business. Minneapolis talked about the fact that they have a parkway system, and they have a lot of cultural institutions, and that brings a lot of people into their cities to use their services that don't normally pay taxes, but increase the need. A number of other cities mentioned things like universities. You know, having a university located in your city would increase your need per capita. And when we tried looking at factors that measured those specific things, none of them ended up being significant. But all of those different factors were highly correlated with accident rates. It's because of kind of a measure of congestion caused by this overburden from a number of different characteristics. And so that's really what it's a proxy for.
Thank you.
Bottom line, Representative DeLaForest, the more people that ride the train, the less LGA Minneapolis gets.
I'll bear that in mind, Mr. Chair.
Sure, there's more accidents there, too.
We'll find out about the accident rate in the future.
Only
so.
Two.
Okay. Ms. Dalton, you want to continue then?
I will just briefly mention that there are a couple of pages, page 22 and 23 in the handout, that talk briefly about the aid cuts that were made to all the different local governments in 2003 and 2004, and it talks about how those cuts were made and how much was made from each type of jurisdiction, but I'm not going to cover that here. If people have questions about that, they can talk to us later. The other thing that I'm going to talk about is levy limits. Levy limits generally are a limit on what a city can raise from levy plus general purpose aid. Currently, there are no levy limits for pay 2005 and future years. Levy limits expired in 2004. Usually, when levy limits are in effect, they apply to counties and to cities with a population over 2,500. Normally, the levy limits allow some growth in city levies based on inflation and normally, you know, city growth, both population and new construction of commercial and industrial growth. There are normally some levies for some purposes which are allowed outside of levy limits. The major one is debt, but there's also been some for some jail issues, for natural disasters, and some other issues. As I said, currently levy limits are not in place.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, what is the history on levy limits versus tax rate limits? Why use one and not the other? I guess is my question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've never really had tax rate limits in a broad general sense in this state. We've limited tax rate of what can be levied for specific purposes in some individual for some individual services. The main reason that I think levy limits were probably done the way they are, which, as I said, is a levy limit on levy plus general purpose aids, is that they were really enacted first to ensure that state aids that went to local governments got passed on as property tax reductions. They were first enacted in 1972 as part of the Minnesota Miracle, when we were suddenly going to give a lot of state aid. They were removed in 1994 and were replaced with truth and taxation hearings. And since then, they've gone on and off, you know, for a couple of years at a time. And normally, they have, in the recent past, they've been on, again, either when we've done major shifts in where aids have been going. We've taken some city and town aids and moved it to school districts, and we wanted to make sure that, you know, people didn't play games with what was happening to their levies, given the confusion about what was happening to aids. Or there have been major aid cuts, and in 2004, cities and counties were not allowed to levy back all of their aid cut. They were only allowed to levy back about 60% of their aid cuts. So normally, the reason we have gone for levy limits as opposed to rate limits is to recognize that relationship between state general purpose aids and property tax levies.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Matt, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton, you mentioned cities and counties. What about, are school districts now unlimited? And can they do it for anything?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, school districts are, we don't talk about them much here because we don't have jurisdiction over them, but they basically have a levy limit system in place that applies on each sort of category of their levy has a limit. There's a health and safety limit, and there's a community education limit, et cetera. There are many different categories that each have their own levy. Much of the school levy that's actually levied is school referendum levy, which is levy that has been approved by the voters in the district, and or school debt levy, which is, again, levies that have been approved by the voters just to cover bonds. But there's no real general authority for school boards to levy whatever they want. All of their levy is subject to some kind of limit. The next topic we're going to go into is the two major credit programs that are in existence now, the market value credit programs. And on page 26 of your handout, the discussion of the homestead market value credit. This is another new component of the tax system that came into being with the 2001 major property tax overhaul. And the homestead market value credit is actually kind of a simple program. It simply says each home is entitled to a reduction in its property tax based only on the value of the home. No other factors come into play. It's kind of an unusual formula in some ways, in that the amount of credit per home goes up with the value of your home. Up to a value of $76,000, and at that point the value of the credit is $304. Then once your value of the home is above $76,000, the credit actually reduces by about $90 per $100,000 of value, to the point where there's no credit for a home valued over $414,000. And the somewhat unusual structure has to do with the idea that the class rate system was changed quite a bit in 2001, made more uniform, and this credit structure somewhat preserved some of the old features of the class rate system, where there had been some change at about at $76,000. So this program has another unusual characteristic in that it actually decreases as the cost of the state each year, because as homes rise in value, the amount of credit, once it's about $76,000, goes down. So generally, when you look at the state budget, you'll see that the amount of homestead market value credit declines as you look further out into a future biennium. The credit, maybe one more thing to say, is that each home's tax is computed based on its class rates and then the tax rates of the local jurisdictions levying on the property. Once you've computed a gross tax from all the local levies, then you subtract this amount of the market value credit to determine the net tax burden on the homestead. Then, in order to make the local governments whole, the amount of that reduction has to be sent back from the state to the taxing jurisdictions, and we often refer to that as the market value credit reimbursement payment. So each school district, city, county, township, special tax district actually gets a check from the state to replace the amount of credit dollars that were taken off the individual taxpayer's property tax statement.
Mr. Hines, if Representative Broad has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, again. Mr. Hines, I need a little history on why this money doesn't just go to the people and is funneled through local governments.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I guess in some sense we think of this kind of a credit program as going directly to the people because the local government first compute their tax on the property and then the state decides how much they're going to relieve the property owner by having this subtraction kind of on the bottom line, right before the bottom line. But administratively, the idea of sort of sending checks to individuals would be a much more complicated and cumbersome task than just having the auditor, when they compute the statement, say, the state's going to give this a home valued at $76,000, a $300 check, take it off their property tax statement, and the state will compensate the jurisdictions for that amount. So in a way, we think of it as relief to the individual taxpayer, but the check actually goes to the jurisdiction.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hines, when the year that this was not paid, or the 2 years, I'm not sure which anymore, did the cities not get the money, but the homeowners still got the relief?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, yes. In 2003 and 2004, in response to the budget shortfall, there was some cities basically had their this reimbursement payment from the state back to the cities, basically provided that check would not be paid in full, so that the homeowner would continue to have the full value of the credit deducted from their taxes due on their statement, but then when it came to the city getting compensated for that reduction, for certain cities whose basically did receive little or no LGA, they did not receive the full reimbursement payment. And that those were for 2 years, calendar years 03 and 04 only. The next page in the handout refers to a very similar program called the Agricultural Market Value Credit. And this program applies to the value, the land and building value of an agricultural homestead. So the domicile portion of the ag homestead gets the homestead credit as described on page 26. The agricultural credit applies to the remaining parts of the property. It has somewhat of a similar structure in that the amount of the credit goes up to a maximum of $345, which is reached at a farm value of $115,000 or a land and building value of $115,000. Then the amount of credit is actually reduced, but any farm valued over $345,000 receives a credit of $230. So it reduces, but it doesn't go all the way to zero the way it does for residential homesteads. Again, this had to do with the transition from the old class rate system that had been in effect before 2001 to the new one. This program costs about $24 million a year, so it's at a different order of magnitude from the residential homestead market value credit. And this one, again, has the characteristic that it can decline a little as the property's value increases, but it's really been pretty stable at that $24 million for the last 2 or 3 years.
Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the homestead market value credit issue again, and wondering if you could talk about how this credit program and limited market value interact. And as you talked about earlier, that limited market value is slated to go off. What impact might that have on this market value credit program? How do the two policies interconnect in some way or affect each other in some way?
Mr. Timmer, Representative Lanning, you're very right to observe that even with limited market value, the state cost of that credit program is decreasing over time fairly dramatically each year. As limited market value goes away and home values, taxable value of homes increase at an even faster rate, that will bring that state cost of the homestead market value credit down even more quickly. An interesting sidelight, though, of that aspect is if proposals are brought forward to restrict the rate at which limited market value goes away or terminate the sunsetting altogether, those end up having a state cost because current law is allowing values to go up and the credit to go down. If you stop those values from going down as fast, then the state cost of that credit becomes higher in the out years. So that's an interesting sidelight for people that don't think they're affecting state programs, but when they're talking about the LMP, it does end up imposing state costs.
Thank you.
We are going to skip the tax increment financing pages for now, and we are going to move directly to the mining and the PTR, and I'm going to finish out this morning real quickly in the next 5 minutes with that. Mines and facilities that are used in the production of taconite are exempt from property tax, and in lieu of that, they pay a production tax. That production tax was $73 million, which was paid in 2004, and that's based on 2003 production. Now, I might add, they also pay another about $5 million in occupation and sales and miscellaneous, but I'm not mentioning that really much here because most of their tax is paid in production. It's about 95% of their total. The production tax rate is $2 and then 10, and it's carried out to the third digit, so 103 per taxable ton, and that is the tax base is a three-year average production, and that three-year production average is done for stability, so that you average tonnage over a three-year period, just so that you don't get that up and down kind of for the cycle. The production tax, as I mentioned, it isn't in lieu of property tax, and it becomes a major tax revenue source for the jurisdictions that are in the taconite tax relief area. And on page 34 of the handout, there is some more description, and it also describes, for instance, which counties are in the taconite tax relief area, Cook and Lake, St. Louis, Itasca, and It has those, and it also has a table in there which actually shows what the distribution of those $73 million are, and it's based on cents per taxable ton, but that is actually specified in statute, so that the cents per taxable ton is a number that needs statutory change if, in fact, that was to be done. Then moving on, the last thing that we're going to talk about this morning is just for a couple minutes, and that's the property tax refund. The property tax refund is, and some people refer to it as circuit breaker, it provides property tax relief to homeowners and to renters whose property taxes are high relative to their incomes. If the property tax exceeds a certain threshold percentage of income, and that might be 2 or 3%, there's a schedule in statute, then the refund equals a percentage of the tax that's over that threshold. And the percentage of tax that they receive, there is a copayment, so there's a schedule in statute that shows how much the renter or homeowner has to pay and how much the state is going to pay. The property tax refund was changed and expanded quite a bit as part of the 2001 tax reform, and at that point we lowered thresholds and increased maximums and also increased the household income that was qualifying. The next page, or the next slide, shows the property tax refund amount for refunds filed in 2003, $252 million, and you can see that there were 505,000 filers, and the average refund was right about $500 or $498. The subtotals, we didn't subtotal like homeowner and renter, but it's interesting because it's pretty close. The number of filers for homeowners are 234,000, and the number of renters are 271, so it's a relatively equal distribution. The homeowners use the actual property taxes. In the case of renters, renters don't pay property taxes directly, but they do pay through their rent. And in statute, rent constituting property taxes, which is the term used, is assumed to be 19% of rent paid. And so that's the percentage that we are using for calculating. The next slide is just shows the various program limits. For homeowners, the maximum income, and that is household income, and it's $85,210. This is an index number, and this is what it is for refunds filed in 2005. And the maximum refund is $1,590. In the case of renters, the maximum income is $45,970, and the maximum refund is $1,310. Finishing up, the special property tax refund, often referred to as targeting, is one that a lot of people don't realize because it's one that it has household income is not considered as part of it, and it is on the back of the form for the property tax refund, but if a person doesn't fill out the property tax refund and doesn't qualify for that, you may not know that you can qualify for this. What it does is it provides relief to homeowners with more than a 12% tax increase, and that tax increase has to come, rephrase, the tax increase cannot come from new construction. So you can't do an addition onto your house and have a tax increase as a result of that. But it can come, for instance, from a school referendum. It could be that you passed a huge referendum and you have, as a result, a large tax increase, and that 12% can be triggered by that. As you can tell, and this just says for returns filed in 2003, but the amount that we pay in targeting really varies from one year to the next because it is based on, the increase over the previous year. And for 2003 filing, and that's the latest that we have on so far from revenue, it was $7.6 million, 90,000 returns for an average of $84. So it's a fairly small amount. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I think we are done.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, we will have no committee meeting next Tuesday, the 18th of January, due to the Governor's State of the State Address. We will have no committee meeting next Wednesday, the 19th. But next Thursday, January 20th, we will take up Representative Abrams, House File 47. That is the legislation dealing with the correcting the calculation of LGA. Something you may remember was a rather hot topic last fall. So anyway, we'll, as I said, we'll take that up on Thursday the 20th. No further comments or questions. Committee adjourned.